Welcome to this special presentation of Could We See Two Suns in 5 Years by Marshall Masters, a former CNN science feature producer and the publisher of the Colburn Bible. You can learn more about this 3,600-year-old secular wisdom text at colburn.com. That's K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com.
Within the coming decade, we could look up and see a second sun through a copper-colored sky. Could our old friend Sol actually have a smaller unborn twin, a brown dwarf that's larger than the planet Jupiter? If this notion sounds a bit over the top, then consider the following. According to NASA, over 80% of the solar systems in our universe have multiple suns, and the Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes are now searching the heavens for nearby brown dwarfs as never before. We're finding them in distant solar systems. But what about our own solar system? We're looking there too. In the past few years, we've learned so much about the far edge of our solar system that science has had to redefine our very notion of a planet. In the process, we've completely remapped our solar system. On the downside, Pluto was demoted to the rank of a minor planet, much to the consternation of astrologers. On the upside, though, we inherited a new dwarf planet between Mars and Jupiter. Called Ceres, it has what appears to be a very thin atmosphere. Beyond Pluto, the search is on for extrasolar planets in orbit around nearby stars, and the hope of finding new Earths to colonize. To date, well over 200 gas and ice giants have been found, and the pace of discovery is increasing at an exponential rate. Meanwhile, at home, climatologists now blame global warming on an historic increase in solar activity. However, if you still believe human pollution is the real culprit, then why have our governments initiated a crash program to launch a new fleet of solar observatories into space between now and 2008? So could there be one common link that ties all these questions together with one simple answer? And if so, what does that mean to those of us living today? We're going to explore these compelling and timely questions using the latest scientific data, prophecy, folklore, and paranormal experience. So join me now as we explore the possibility that we could see two suns in 5 years. If we do live in a binary star system with two suns, the general acceptance of this new reality will not happen until we first put aside our own archaic, Earth-centric view of the universe. It is easy for us to think of our solar system as being stable and predictable, yet the span of a human life wouldn't even amount to a blink of an eye in the cosmological sense. Consequently, our notion of a stable and predictable system is really nothing more than a few dots in a tiny snapshot of time. Yet odd things can and do happen in the cosmological blink of an eye. A good example can be found in the last visit of Comet Hale-Bopp, the flyby of this 25-mile-wide comet in 1997 was a major event for astronomers and enthusiasts alike. However, what most of us remember about Comet Hale-Bopp is what happened to the 39 members of the Heaven's Gate UFO cult. They committed mass suicide so their souls could be transported to a spaceship hiding behind the comet. It was a shocking and memorable loss of life, but in all the media coverage, something critical was passed over. This was the radical change in Hale-Bopp's orbit, which happens to be perpendicular to the ecliptic. For the sake of comparison, think of planets as orbiting the Sun from left to right, whereas Hale-Bopp orbits our Sun from top to bottom. During the last passage, Hale-Bopp's orbit of 4,200 years went down to just 2,380. Astronomers tell us It happened when the comet passed within 0.77 AU of Jupiter. That's a little farther than the distance between the planet Venus and our Sun. In this special audio report, we'll examine the possibility that a brown dwarf, slightly larger than Jupiter, is orbiting our Sun much in the same manner as Hale-Bopp. Should this be the case, sometime within the coming decade, every soul on Earth will look up into a copper-colored sky and see two suns overhead. One will be our old friend Sol. The other will be its destructive unborn twin, an object often referred to as Planet X on the Internet. How long have I wondered about this possibility? That's easy. Stanley Kubrick's film 2001: A Space Odyssey was eye-opening, but its sequel, 2010, which ends with two suns in our sky, is what really piqued my attention. That was a benign picture of the future. However, years of research have revealed to me another picture, one that is not so benign. It is described by the ancients, along with sobering harbinger signs that speak to the present. While Planet X could be any number of things, one thing is for certain. The ancients tell us it has been here before. They also give us foreboding prophecies of cataclysm for its next return. In this special report, we'll look at this darker possibility with two possible Planet X return scenarios, one centered on 2012 and the other for 3797. In the end, you'll see a possible future that may alarm and inspire you. We'll also look at what the governments of the world are doing about this and what they're not telling us. And finally, we'll look at what each of us can do on a personal level should this evolutionary event come to pass. In the days of Moses, the ancient Egyptians referred to Planet X as the Destroyer or Doomshape. This according to the Colburn Bible, a newly revealed 3,600-year-old secular anthology that corroborates the ancient Sumerian descriptions of a planet they called Nibiru. Sumer is the oldest known human civilization, and it once thrived in what is now present-day Iraq. According to the Colburn Bible, the last two flybys of the Doomshape, or what we call Planet X, was responsible for Noah's flood and the 10 plagues of Exodus. Additionally, the Colburn Bible offers Planet X historical accounts that were penned by Celtic priests in Britain shortly after the death of Jesus. The Celts and their Druid ancestors referred to Planet X as the Frightener. What is of critical concern to us is that the ancient Sumerians, Egyptians, and Celts all prophesied the return of Planet X in our time. However, none of them gave an exact date. Therefore, the closest thing we do have to a specific date is found on the other side of the world. It is known to us as the 2012 Mayan calendar prophecy. Like the Hopi Indians of North America, the Mayans tell us that planet Venus will herald the return of what they called the Red Comet in 2012. Unfortunately, we'll never know exactly why the Mayans chose Venus, because nearly all of their ancient codices were destroyed by Spanish Jesuits in 1562. However, Mayan anthropologist George Erickson tells us that the beginning of the next Mayan calendar on December 21, 2012, will signal a major astronomical event. Still the same, this vital knowledge perished needlessly, which leaves us with only one certain conclusion. As Venus goes, so goes the Earth, and this nagging puzzle remains to this day. This is why I've collaborated with other Planet X researchers worldwide since the turn of the millennium. Our mission is to seek the truth about these and other Planet X questions, regardless of where it leads us. Along the way, we've amassed a great amount of Planet X data from scientific reports, ancient folklore, and paranormal observations. For some, it has been like trying to put together a jigsaw puzzle with no picture and only half the pieces. As for me, all of this Planet X data has buzzed about my head like an angry swarm of bees. That's why I recently narrowed my search to finding that one scientific theory that would make sense of it all. And, much like a queen bee, it would give this data a swarm a singular, coherent purpose. Well, it wasn't long before I found the honey jar in an effect described in 1962 by the Japanese astronomer Yoshide Kozai. It is called the Kozai mechanism, and it explains in very predictable terms how large objects in space orbit about each other. For me, it was the linchpin that connected all of my Planet X data together. This is why I come to think of my last 5 years as a journey to Kozai. And as with all journeys, there has to be a reason. In my case, you could say that reason dates back to March 13, 1781. This was the day English astronomer Sir William Herschel discovered the planet Uranus. That's because this discovery is what started turning the wheels of science towards Planet X, and for two principal reasons. Unlike the planets we inherited from our ancestors, Uranus was the first major planet discovered in modern recorded history. That made it ours, which in turn brings me to the second point. It didn't take long for astronomers to observe perturbations in the orbit of our planet to know that it was misbehaving, that is, relative to Newton's laws of gravity. This discovery focused their attention on finding the source of this observed perturbation, and to paraphrase Sherlock Holmes, the game has been afoot to this very day. So is Planet X a term coined by stodgy old European astronomers? Or is it a creation of modern-day internet pop culture aficionados? The answer is neither, which is why we need to discuss two men, English mathematician John Couch Adams and American astronomer Percival Lowell. In 1845, Adams predicted that another ice giant orbits our sun beyond Uranus. Because he was young, his peers ignored him. Yet history proved him right in 1846 with the discovery of the planet Neptune. Adams also theorized that Neptune's perturber would be orbiting our sun at a distance 2 to 3 times the distance from our sun to Neptune. It was an intriguing idea, and at the beginning of the 20th century, an ingenious American would pick up the idea and run with it. He was Percival Lowell, a successful businessman turned astronomer who built a private observatory in Flagstaff, Arizona. He used this observatory to map the canals on Mars, and his observations would later earn him a great deal of notoriety. Yet, his secret ambition was to find the Adams perturber out beyond the edge of our solar system, an object he dubbed Planet X, which makes him the father of this popular term. A direct result of Lowell's search for Planet X was the discovery of Pluto by his assistant, Clyde Tombaugh, in 1930. Initially, many believed Pluto was the object Adams had theorized about. However, Pluto was soon found to lack the mass necessary to be Planet X. And if that wasn't bad enough, this year, astronomers demoted Pluto from the status of planet to that of minor planet. So does this mean the search for Planet X is over? Absolutely not. This is because of something called the Kuiper Gap. Beyond the edge of our solar system is a huge ball of debris. It is what remains of the creation of our solar system. We call it the Oort cloud, and it contains enough debris to create at least one more planet the size of Jupiter. The Oort cloud is divided into two parts: the outer Oort cloud and the inner Oort cloud, or what is more commonly known as the Kuiper Belt. It is within the Kuiper Belt we find the Kuiper Gap, an unusually empty swath of space that exists at a distance approximately twice that of the distance between the Sun and Pluto. What makes the Kuiper Gap unusual is that it seems as though it was created by some large object that pass through it like a huge celestial vacuum cleaner. This huge celestial vacuum cleaner could very well be our elusive Planet X, the perturber that John Couch Adams envisioned. Likewise, here is where the COSY mechanism fits in perfectly, because it explains how one object in orbit around the Sun can perturb the orbits of one or more other objects. For the purpose of this discussion, let's take a simple view of the COSY mechanism, beginning with the ecliptic. One way to think of the ecliptic is to imagine yourself at the center of the Sun, then shoot a laser beam out from the center of the Sun, through its equator, and out into deep space. There at the other end of the beam will be the 12 signs of the zodiac. In between, we see the planets in our solar system, passing through or near this laser beam as they trundle along in their stable orbits around the Sun. According to the COSY mechanism, this is a celestial happy spot, so to speak. That's because things just keep on working there in a nice, predictable manner. Now, as much as we all like things to be predictable, the COSY mechanism also shows what can happen when the orbit of a large object opposes this celestial happy spot. And that, in a word, is chaos. To illustrate this chaos, let's imagine the ecliptic is now a marble tabletop. Next, let's imagine our planets and moons are perfectly balanced wooden spinning tops, such as the ones children love to play with. So now we wrap our strings about them and give them a pull, one by one. In short order, we have several tops on the table, and all of them are spinning in the celestial happy spot of the COSY mechanism. Now let's add chaos to the picture by dropping an unbalanced spinning top on the table. For the sake of argument, let's call it the perturber. The instant our perturber lands on the table, it begins skittering back and forth like a drunken sailor. Then it starts slamming into the other tops, knocking them out of their celestial sweet spots. In very little time, our table becomes a picture of chaos as tops fly off every edge. Now let's assume that our perturber, which wreaked havoc on our tabletop, and Planet X are one and the same. If this is the case, it stands to reason that Planet X has already perturbed our Sun, and most if not all of the other major planets in our solar system. To see if this is possible, let's briefly discuss a topic we're all familiar with: global warming. In 2001, I joined fellow researchers in the conclusion that global warming is real, and that it is primarily caused by solar activity. Human pollution, which is considerable, only plays an aggravating secondary role. When we released our findings, we were immediately ridiculed. I suppose this is why I'm so fond of John Couch Adams. Kept on doing his thing and was fortunate enough to see some of his theories become scientific fact. In the same vein, our 2001 global warming findings have been recently validated as well. According to scientists based at the Institute for Astronomy in Zurich, our Sun is more violent now than at any time in the last 1,000 years. Another study by Dutch meteorologists tells us that temperature increases of the last 60 years are the largest in this same period of time. Now here's the kicker. That was the good news. The bad news is that this trend will continue upward through the next 11-year solar maximum. According to NASA, the next solar maximum, which starts in 2007, will reach its peak in 2012. At that point, it is estimated to be half again worse than the last, and many feel that's a rather conservative estimate. Why is that? Prior to this last solar maximum, the highest catastrophic solar flare category was X. However, during this last solar maximum, a whole new catastrophic Y category had to be created. So let's now put this into a larger context. Up to now, we've looked at how the Sun has become more violent, and how this increased solar activity became the principal engine of global warming for the Earth. So does this also mean that the other planets in our solar system are evidencing similar surface perturbations. According to several prestigious observatories, this is exactly what's happening. For example, recent surface warming on Mars and Pluto was so severe that similar events on Earth would have caused an extinction-level event. In fact, every planet in our system is evidencing some form of surface perturbation. These range from radical climate and weather changes to the new radio and X-ray emissions that are popping up everywhere. To put this in context, imagine that you're standing in the middle of a dark theater. At first, everything is cool and quiet. Then, without warning, a lighting technician begins switching on every bank of lights in the house. That, in a manner of speaking, is what our solar system is doing. Because it's showtime, folks. And at the top of the bill is none other than our grand old perturber, Planet X. Perhaps now would be a good time to take a closer look at what Planet X could be and what it could do to us. Earlier, we first imagined the ecliptic as a laser beam extending from the center of the Sun out to the constellations of the zodiac. Along that beam, the planets of our solar system orbit our Sun in the celestial sweet spot of the Kozai mechanism. With this orderly and predictable vision in mind, let's now investigate two rather interesting aspects of the precession of the equinoxes. In the everyday life sense, the precession of the equinoxes determines where we'll find the North Star at night, when to put snow tires on the car, and when to smear on the suntan lotion. For those of you who can remember watching Neil Armstrong set foot on the moon back in 1969, you might also remember The Age of Aquarius by the Fifth Dimension. It was a catchy, upbeat song that promised a more peaceful world in the coming Age of Aquarius. This will happen when the Sun is directly in between the Earth and the constellation of Aquarius. And interestingly enough, it is also part of the precession of the equinoxes. So what does the Age of Aquarius have to do with Planet X? Plenty, as you'll soon see. But first, let's briefly revisit the idea that Planet X could be an unborn companion to our own Sun, or what astronomers call a brown dwarf. What is the difference between a Sun like our own and a brown dwarf? A brown dwarf is an unborn Sun that lacks the mass necessary to sustain nuclear fusion. This is why a brown dwarf may be quite visible when it is young, but with age, it will come to resemble a dusty bed of red-hot embers. Humankind has long believed that there is only one Sun in our solar system. So what are the chances that we live in a binary solar system with two suns? Well, according to NASA, the chance of that happening is better than 80%. Ergo, to continue believing that we live in a solar system with only one sun, we must also view ourselves as the exception to the rule, and not the other way around. Okay, so what does all of this binary solar system stuff have to do with the precession of the equinoxes and the coming age of Aquarius? Well, here it is. The Earth is not moving forward through the zodiac into Aquarius, but rather, we're sliding backwards into it. This is all fine and good, but what's really interesting is that we're sliding backwards into Aquarius at an ever-increasing speed. This curious fact explains why astronomers and astrologers must use something called precession compensation to factor in this ever-changing difference. It also begs two very obvious questions. Given that astronomers recently demoted Pluto to a minor planet, is it wise of us to blindly cling to the old belief that we only have one sun? And if so, what could possibly be causing our planet to move backwards through the zodiac at an ever-increasing speed? Before you paint these questions as being trivial, please consider the following experiment. If you want to boil a frog alive without him noticing it, start by putting him in a pot of cold water. Then very, very, very slowly heat the water to a boil. If you do it right, the frog will keep adjusting to the water temperature increases until it is literally cooked in its own juices. Likewise, could the same be happening to us? Ask yourself, are we oblivious to the possible danger of Planet X because it is happening slowly enough for us to keep adjusting to it? Perhaps this is why humanity has always held a deep respect for prophecy and folklore. Not because they are scientifically precise, but rather because they offer us harbinger signs of future dangers. This is why prophecy and folklore are so vital to human survival. They tell us when to jump out of the pot so that we're not boiled alive by our own comfort mechanisms. With regard to Planet X, the prophecies of the Colburn Bible, Nostradamus, Mother Shipton, and the Mayans are all giving us the same warning. Get out of the pot. With that in mind, let's take a closer look at those warnings. Two notable prophecies come from Nostradamus and Mother Shipton. In a letter to his son Caesar, Nostradamus tells us his predictions end in 3797. Was this an arbitrary end to his prophecies, or one that signals the destruction of Earth at this time? According to Nostradamus scholars such as author John Hoag, 3797 is not an arbitrary end date. Rather, when considered along with the other prophecies of Nostradamus, a different picture emerges. According to their analysis, Nostradamus is telling us that our sun will suddenly expand in 3797 and then destroy the Earth. However, well before that happens, our descendants will be colonizing new worlds in the constellation of Cancer. Astronomers tell us it will be a few thousand million years before the sun could possibly present such a risk. So all things being equal, what could cause a catastrophic expansion of our sun in 3797? Did Nostradamus see something we've missed, or is it the other way around? We'll explore that question in more depth later on, but for now, let's examine a different Planet X prophecy that speaks directly to us. It is from a 15th century English seeress known to us as Mother Shipton. In her short but insightful prophecies, she gives only one date by which we can vet her predictive powers. It reads as follows. In 1926, build houses light of straw and sticks, for then shall mighty wars be planned, and fire and sword shall sweep the land. This centuries-old prophecy was fulfilled in the summer of 1926, because this is when Adolf Hitler began planning World War II and his Thousand-Year Reich in the Bavarian village of Berzgarten. Hitler would later remember 1926 as one of the best years of his life. Unlike Nostradamus, whose prophecies jump backwards and forwards through time, Mother Shipton's prophecies are linear and go thousands of years beyond us into the future. A bit further on from the 1926 prophecy, Mother Shipton speaks to our time when she says, "A fiery dragon will cross the sky six times before this earth shall die. Mankind will tremble and frightened be, for the sixth heralds in this prophecy." Over the last few years, I've labored with other researchers to understand Mother Shipton's warning that a fiery dragon will cross the sky six times before this earth shall die. Try as we might, nothing ever seemed to fit. That was until I read the Colburn Bible, a newly revealed Egyptian-Celtic wisdom text dating back 3,600 years. This secular anthology offers the knowledge of those who survived past global catastrophes. Until the Sumatra superquake and tsunami of December 2004, and then Katrina in 2005, who amongst us could have truly imagined such cataclysms happening today? Yet the Egyptian and Celtic authors of the Colburn Bible frequently warn us that an object they call the Doomshaper or Destroyer will return soon and cause another global cataclysm. Other than warning us it will happen again, do the authors of this work offer a description of what that future cataclysm will be like? No, because this book was not written by victors or those inspired by God. Rather, it was written by teachers and scribes, and they tell us this object caused Noah's flood and the 10 plagues of Exodus. While there are similarities to other ancient texts such as the Torah or Old Testament, the historical accounts in the Colburn Bible retain a secular, pre-essent style. They are so factual they come across like man-on-the-street TV interviews. Their historical accounts of Noah's flood and the 10 plagues of Exodus have proven invaluable beyond measure to my own Planet X research. However, I believe that one passage from the Book of Manuscripts is the one of greatest concern to us living today. It tells us, "When ages pass, certain laws operate upon the stars in the heavens. Their ways change. There is movement and restlessness. They are no longer constant, and a great light appears redly in the skies." Given all we've discussed so far, does this passage ring a bell? Or in other words, had I read it at the top of the program, would it now make as much sense? Please understand, I'm not asking you to take sides here, as each of us has to find the truth in our own way. Rather, I need to make a point. Were it not for my previous years of scientific research, I would have overlooked the significance of this historical account in the Colburn Bible, one that connects the Kozai mechanism directly to the ancients, and how they understood the universe. Consequently, when we combine the prophecies of Nostradamus, Mother Shipton, the Mayans, and the Colburn Bible, a very old understanding of the universe reveals itself, one that tells us a large reddish object will pass through our system on its rendezvous with disaster for the Earth on or about December 21, 2012, the day on which the present Mayan calendar ends and the next begins. But how much faith can we put into this 2012 date? According to noted Mayan anthropologist and author George Erickson, the Mayans were incredible navigators and astronomers. They, like the ancient Sumerians and Egyptians, observed Venus for harbinger signs of an object they called the Red Comet. He further tells us the Mayan calendar is timed to major astronomical events, such as a red comet crossing the ecliptic from above or below. This brings us back to our early discussion of Nostradamus' prophecy about the destruction of Earth in 3797, and the big picture. If we map out all these prophecies in chronological order, we see a straight line that begins with Noah's flood. Next, it passes through to the 10 plagues of Exodus, and then jumps ahead to the Mayan and Mother Shipton prophecies in 2012. Following that, it continues forward in time to its end, with Nostradamus and the destruction of Earth in 3797. Now here is the really interesting part. The only tool that we can possibly use to draw this line that begins with Noah's flood and ends with the destruction of Earth in 3797 is the Kozai mechanism. So how did I manage to find this theoretical Japanese linchpin? Interestingly enough, the answer to that question also comes from Japan. During the Cold War, remote viewing was intensively studied by the American CIA and the Soviet KGB. Both agencies saw it as a way to use intuitive psychic abilities to obtain vital intelligence about remote objects, places, and persons. Although promising, the intelligence agencies found the technique flawed for the purpose of war. However, it does work when used for wholesome purposes, and is taught today throughout the world. One of the top remote viewing teachers in the field is Eihan Derave of Japan. He is also the author of Solar Code, a Planet X researcher, and a popular lecturer. Ahan's remote viewing method is very popular in Japan for two reasons. First, because it is much less stressful for viewers than other methods taught in other countries. And second, because it employs the time-tested integrity monitoring techniques developed by the CIA to ensure quality results. I became acquainted with Ahan in 2004, shortly after he graduated a small class of students. As a final assignment, Ahan had his students use their newly acquired skills to remote view Planet X. Before discussing the results of that remote viewing graduation assignment, let's address the significance of the dust that surrounds this massive red object approaching from the south. Although the majority of Ahan's students had little or no previous knowledge of Planet X, they viewed it as a massive, dust-shrouded, reddish object. What is interesting about these views is that they are consistent with the many accounts described to me in the emails I've received from individuals from all around the globe. Whether in a dream or vision, they all report this same dust-shrouded, reddish object. While these accounts vary in terms of actual location, they all speak to the reddish color of the object, its massive size, and the dust cloud surrounding it. As I mentioned earlier, a brown dwarf is an unborn star. So let's frame this in the context of what these remote viewers and psychic experiencers were seeing. Brown dwarfs are unborn stars, and as such, they're surrounded by the dust and debris of their own protoplanetary disks. When our sun was forming, it also had a protoplanetary disk. Once it gathered enough mass to be born, most of its protoplanetary disk coalesced into the major bodies of our solar system. The rest formed a massive bubble of debris that surrounds our solar system called the Oort cloud. Assuming that Planet X is a brown dwarf, the dust and debris within its protoplanetary disk will make it extremely difficult to find in the visible light ranges, that is, until it comes closer to the sun. Assuming it is coming up from the south and that it will cross the ecliptic in 2012, those of us living in the northern hemisphere will begin to see it sometime around 2010. By 2012, it will be visible during the day and appear as a second sun in the sky. That being said, the most intriguing remote viewing report from Ahan's class came from one student who had never heard of Planet X before. What piqued my curiosity about this report was that it was the very first to show a pattern of movement. What this student remote viewer saw was a star spinning downwards in a cone-shaped spiral. This was different from everything else, and even though I couldn't make sense of it at the time, the image always stayed in my mind. I'm glad it did, because 2 years later, it would make perfect sense. While discussing the COSI mechanism with fellow researchers Jaco van der Warp and Andy Lloyd in September 2006, something started to click. Jaco and Andy were running computer simulations based on the COSI mechanism, and what they were finding was playing sheer hill with their previous theories, which presumed that we have a stable solar system that plays according to the human rule book. No matter how many times they ran the simulations, the result was always the same. Planet X as a brown dwarf cannot exist within a stable orbit that is perpendicular to the ecliptic. Further, it would destabilize the orbits of all of the other planets in our solar system as it spirals slowly into a final destructive plunge into our sun. As I listened to Jaco and Andy debate the notion of this decaying orbit, the hand drawing that Ahan's remote viewing student had made of that large object in a spiraling cone clicked. It looked incredibly similar to the plots we were getting with our COSI mechanism simulations. The following day, I confirmed the COSI mechanism simulation data with Jaco. Then I asked him to assume that we're in a binary system and the orbit of our sun's unborn twin had been in a stable, circular orbit around our sun for most of its life, but that eons ago, something destabilized it. Would that explain the simulation results they were getting? Jaco answered immediately, yes. how. I finally had an explanation for the cone-shaped concentric spiral drawn by Ehan's remote viewing student. In simple terms, it was a Kozai mechanism simulation that worked. Finally, all the pieces started coming together. The fact that every major body in our solar system with an atmosphere is showing new radio and X-ray emissions along with marked climate and surface temperatures. The fact that our sun is in a frenzy since 1940, according to the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and will become even more violent between now and 2012, according to NASA. The Kuiper Gap looks like a wide, empty swath at the outer edge of our solar system, as though a huge vacuum cleaner had swept through the Kuiper Belt. The fact that Earth is moving backwards through the zodiac with ever-increasing speed. Historical accounts in the Colburn Bible that tells us this object caused Noah's flood and the plagues of Exodus. And finally, the prophecy of Mother Shipton that tells us 2012 will likely be the fifth time this object passes through our system with destructive results. So now we come to the logical question. If this is so, are our governments doing something about it? And if so, what? Well, they are doing something, and they are telling us about that, and I'll explain this in great detail. But first, I need to tell you what our governments are not doing. They're not telling us why. Taken all together, we see a very frightening picture. The possibility that, eons ago, the stable orbit of our sun's unborn twin was somehow destabilized and that it is now slowly spiraling into our sun. Should this be the case, we can expect another cataclysm on Earth similar to Noah's flood or the 10 plagues of Exodus in 2012. Then in 3797, it will finally plunge into the sun and grind the Earth like grist in the violent mill of a perfect solar storm so great it defies imagination. Should all this be true, our governments must surely know about it by now. If so, what are they doing about it? And more importantly, why are they keeping this from us? For the sake of argument, let's say many of the world's governments have been aware of Planet X for some time now, and they're dealing with it in their own mysterious ways. High on their action lists will be the spin and control issues, such as need to know in public education. How the government views these spin issues is more or less an accepted fact, thanks to pop culture. For example, in the 1997 blockbuster Men in Black, Agent K, played by Tommy Lee Jones, says, "A person is smart. People are dumb, panicky animals, and you know it." If you're a person, the good news is that the government is hiding a good deal of this information out in the open. That's how those of us in the Planet X research community find it, using nothing more than a search engine and a healthy dose of insatiable curiosity. This is not a problem for the governments because in the final analysis, there are only a few Planet X persons bobbing about in this vast sea of people. Hence, everyone is treated like people, which explains why they are not telling us anything until they must. Why is this so? In the words of Jack Nicholson's character in the film A Few Good Men, their message to the people for now is, you can't handle the truth. However, there will come a time when the people will be prepared to act collectively as persons. And to say calmly in one voice, it might shake a little bit, but we'll still say it calmly, now we can handle the truth. And here's a bit of good news. Clear steps are in place to help us arrive at that point. You might think it to be part of a grand government scheme, but in actuality, it is good old-fashioned capitalism at work. Case in point is the steady stream of catastrophe programs on major American networks and cable TV channels, such as Discovery, Learning, Weather, and PBS. Gone are the days of catastrophe entertainment programs replete with dueling pundits and titillating claims designed to bring us back after every commercial break. Now these programs explain past and future catastrophes with straightforward science and no-nonsense scenarios. Is there some big government education conspiracy out there forcing network executives to produce television shows that will fail due to a lack of interest? No. Rather, they're responding to a growing demand for this content. This is because more and more people are awakening to the big picture each day and saying, I'm a person who can handle the truth, so stop wasting my time with entertainment nonsense. Why are more of us people becoming persons who can handle the truth? I believe it is because we're evolving into a more enlightened species, as the prophecies of the Mayans, Nostradamus, and many others tell us. One day, our governments will stop talking to us like people and begin talking to us like persons, because we've earned it. In the meantime, what, if anything, are our governments doing about it? More than you could possibly imagine. If an object such as Planet X is threatening our species, it will no doubt challenge us with a wide range of clear and present dangers. Studying these dangers with an intelligent use of resources is the responsibility of our leaders. This is why they must first identify every threat and need so they can be categorized in order of urgency. Otherwise, the response will go off in every direction and achieve little, if anything at all. The worst threat is that we know so little about Planet X. After all, this is something we've never seen before according to the Colburn Bible. So let's proceed from this point, on the assumption that our governments are scrambling to learn as much about Planet X as possible. This, of course, raises one very curious question. When did our governments first know about this object? According to retired intelligence agency analyst John Maynard, Planet X was first discovered by an infrared imaging spacecraft in 1983 called IRAS. After mapping 95% of the sky, the spacecraft supposedly failed due to a coolant problem, and the American government pulled the project funding. While this brought on many loud protestations by American and British astronomers, a tight lid was nonetheless clamped on a substantial portion of the raw IRAS image data. What actually happened to IRAS? According to Maynard, after Planet X was imaged in the southern region of our solar system below the ecliptic, the project managers were stunned by what they'd found. After that, they ordered the flight controllers to keep the spacecraft aimed at the object for continuous imaging until they exhausted its supply of thruster fuel. Today, NASA's Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes are combing the heavens for nearby brown dwarfs, and they're finding them. Just recently, Hubble discovered CHXR-73b, a brown dwarf in the constellation Chameleon near Earth's celestial south pole. However, this Hubble discovery pales in importance to recent discoveries by the Spitzer Space Telescope. Not only did the Spitzer find brown dwarfs in the constellations of Pisces and Pegasus, it also found considerable evidence to support the theory that small companion suns such as brown dwarfs, like Planet X, can remain virtually unseen in a solar system. The Spitzer data also proves that these brown dwarfs can slowly spiral down into their larger companion stars. And what's of keen interest to us is that they can also destabilize the orbits of all the planets within those systems while doing it. Granted, at this point, you could brush this off by saying, this is all fine and good, but we're just talking about brown dwarfs in some distant solar systems. Perhaps so, perhaps not. In early 2007, American astronomers will begin observing the skies below Earth's celestial south pole with a new observatory at the Edmondson Scott South Pole Station in Antarctica. Called the South Pole Telescope, or SPT for short, it will be the newest and most powerful infrared telescope in the Southern Hemisphere, and good old Uncle Sam is picking up the full tab. Once operational, the 10-meter SPT will be more powerful than the Hubble Space Telescope. In terms of Planet X, the SPT is the perfect instrument at the perfect time and in the most perfect place to observe a brown dwarf approaching from the south. The official reason for the SPT is to search for cosmological anomalies, which is a legitimate reason. Yet one cannot help but wonder why the American government is spending a king's ransom to build, install, and operate this new infrared observatory in the most desolate, inhospitable, and inaccessible region of the world. Wouldn't it make more sense to use a less expensive spacecraft to do the same basic science? While you ponder that question, let's move on to the next high-priority threat, the preservation of our technology infrastructure. Namely, our satellites, telecommunication networks, transportation systems, and power grids. If they're taken out, Western civilization could suddenly find itself back in the Bronze Age. Without a doubt, radical Muslim terror groups pose a huge threat to the internet networks, power grids, and transportation systems we rely upon. However, terrorists are by no means the greatest threat. This is because the greatest threat to our way of life is the prospect of a perfect solar superstorm. One that could slam into our planet like a knockout body blow, and we've already experienced a few sharp jabs. In 1989, a small solar storm crashed the Canadian power grid for almost 9 hours. Tens of thousands of homes were darkened, and the utility company lost millions of dollars in revenue and damage to infrastructure. Why? Because the Canadian government was caught completely unaware. A small solar storm such as this can take up to 4 days to reach the Earth, and it happened again in 1994. This time, another storm damaged two satellites and disrupted the media in Canada. So what happens if we're slammed by a perfect solar storm? For starters, a really violent storm could reach the Earth in less than 18 hours, and unless we're prepared for it, it will lay waste to the modern technologies that shape our lives. No doubt the 1989 solar storm, which brought down a sizable chunk of the Canadian power grid, caught everyone's attention. Consequently, America launched the SOHO Solar Observatory spacecraft in 1995. Since then, this durable craft has fed us an invaluable stream of real-time images of the sun. Despite its advanced age, NASA recently extended its mission life to 2009. In the meantime, a consortium of governments has embarked on an unprecedented effort. Between now and 2008, they will collectively launch a fleet of 5 new solar observatories into space. And here's the roll call. The European Space Agency ESA will launch Proba 2. It will be used to track solar eruptions as they move out into space. The Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency will launch the Solar Bee to investigate the mechanisms responsible for heating the sun's corona. NASA will launch the STEREO pair of spacecraft. Used together, these two solar observatories will give us a first-ever stereoscopic 3D view of our sun and its influences. In 2008, the Solar Dynamics Orbiter will be the 5th solar observatory launched into space. NASA will use it to study a connected sun-Earth system and how it affects life and society on this planet. Once these observatories are fully operational, we can begin studying the sun and its effects on the Earth as never before. But more importantly, we will be able to defend our way of life from the surprise devastation of a perfect solar storm. To be forewarned is to be forearmed, and I, for one, am very glad to see our governments working together so brilliantly for this vital cause. Given that our governments are already doing as much as possible to learn what they can about Planet X and to defend us from devastating solar storms, let's take a look far into the future and see how we can ensure our survival as a species, should the worst happen. The worst-case Planet X scenario for us as a species is not the destruction of this beautiful little blue-green mud ball we call Earth. Rather, it is the destruction of our homeworld, plus every other planet in our solar system. Since this could be a really big problem, where do we first dig in? Perhaps the best place to start is at the mountain fortress of Masada at the edge of the Judean Desert and the Dead Sea Valley in Israel. In 72 CE, the Roman governor Flavius Silva laid siege to the Jewish resistance fighters, who along with their families had taken refuge on top of Masada. When the soldiers of Silva's 10th Legion finally breached the fortress wall, everyone had already committed suicide save for 2 women and 5 children. It was a hollow victory for the Romans, and a defeat that had been largely forgotten by the Jewish people until archaeologists discovered the site. So what was the lesson of Masada? That it is noble to die for your beliefs? No. Absolutely not. The lesson of Masada is that you have to have a plan B. Assuming that the Earth is going to be destroyed in 3797, what should Plan B look like for the human race? Does it mean we need to colonize and terraform the planet Mars as soon as possible? That certainly would be a helpful learning step, but the COSI mechanism and the recent brown dwarf observations of the Spitzer Space Telescope tell us that the failing orbit of Planet X will catastrophically perturb the orbits of every planet in our solar system, Mars included. Ergo, we need to find other solar systems in our galaxy where future generations can colonize new Earths and thereby ensure our survivals as a species. Granted, this is an ambitious technological goal, to say the least. But then again, it only took little more than a century for America to go from the Pony Express to the moon. And we didn't do it because we believed the naysayers. We did it because we believed in our own destiny. This is why I'm delighted to tell you that astronomers are discovering planets in orbit around distant stars at an ever-increasing pace. They're called extrasolar planets, and the first one was discovered in 1988 by Canadian astronomers. Since then, astronomers from all around the globe have successfully confirmed over 200 extrasolar planets to date, and the pace of discovery is increasing at an exponential rate. Yes, the search is on for new Earth-like worlds destined to become lifeboats for humanity that will ensure the survival of our species long after our beloved homeworld is destroyed. As a Planet X researcher, the steps I see our governments taking in response to the possible scenarios we've examined in this program fills me with pride and a noble sense of hope for the future of our species. As much as we may curse them, our governments are doing the right things at the right time and in the best ways possible. The degree to which their efforts will ensure the survival of our species and life as we know it are yet to be known. We nonetheless owe them our support. This is because they are also giving future generations an incredibly precious head start on Plan B, the human colonization of our galaxy. They're not in it for the next business quarter, they're in it for the species. So let's count our blessings, because when fate does kick us out of the nest, it's going to be fly or die time. As for me, I firmly believe we'll make it. So damn the life-sucking pessimists. Why am I so confident? It is because I see our generation paying it forward, just like the generations who authored the Colburn Bible. They suffered previous flybys and knew the next flyby would happen on our watch. Should we drop the ball and allow our species to become extinct, there will be no one to remember them or us. So they sent us their best counsel and most inspiring thoughts in the form of an ancient wisdom text that barely survived the passage of time. One such passage is from the Book of Manuscripts, and it was written at a time when the ancient wisdom text was called the Great Book. It is addressed to those of us living today, and it tells us, "In those days, men will have the Great Book before them. Wisdom will be revealed. The few will be gathered for the stand. It is the hour of trial. The dauntless ones will survive. The stout-hearted will not go down to destruction." The message is clear. The wisdom has now been revealed. It is for you to decide if you shall face whatever comes as a dauntless and stout-hearted person. Planet X may cause another Noah's flood or a 10 plagues of Exodus in 2012. And yes, he could eventually cause the destruction of Earth in 3797. So what can we do about this today as individuals? For starters, each and every one of us can seek the nobility within ourselves to live in service to others. Then we'll have the courage to say to our governments, "I can handle the truth." In the meantime, please remember Marshall's motto. Destiny comes to those who listen and fate finds the rest. So learn what you can learn, do what you can do, and never give up hope. This is Marshall, and I'll catch you on the backside of the flyby.
We thank you for listening to this special presentation of Could We See Two Suns in 5 Years by Marshall Masters, a former CNN science feature producer and the publisher of the Colbrin Bible. You can learn more about this wisdom text at colbrin.com. That's K-O-L-B-R-I-N.com. This concludes this audio program.